From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. An Atlanta newspaper investigated thousands of doctors across the country and found a disturbing pattern.
I don't feel like I'm free because at any time, if something happens, I could be taken to that hospital.
How Georgia is responding to doctors who sexually abuse patients is ahead this hour. But first, last week we asked if you want to know what your coworkers get paid.
Personally, I just think it's a weird thing. I would never ask what my coworkers are making. I mean, I as long as I believe I'm making what I'm worth, I think that's the end of the story.
That's Breakdown regular Jessica Salagi. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Robert Brutz from Athens, Georgia. As a former school teacher, it helped me a lot to know what other school teachers were paid, whether it be in my district with different experience or at the same level in other districts, and helped me decide where it was I wanted to teach.
My name is Melinda Merritt from Americus, Georgia. You were asking whether or not salary should be disclosed. I say yes, because it does cause problems when people find out they're doing the same thing and not getting paid the same money.
We also want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear a case against the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, alleging the company discriminates against older workers by not hiring them in the first place. This leaves in place a ruling from Atlanta's 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Here to discuss the ruling and its implications, Paul Chichester, an Atlanta-based employment attorney. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Tony.
Also joining us is Peter Goslin, contributing reporter for ProPublica. And Peter, welcome. Good morning.
Great to be here, Tony.
Before we get started, we should mention that we asked R.J. Reynolds Company for their reaction to this segment, but they, quote, declined to comment on this case at this time. So, Paul, let me start with you. Are you surprised that the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to take up this case?
I'm not surprised. I think after an en banc hearing like the 11th Circuit had, I think the Supreme Court
wanted to... What does that mean, the en banc?
That's right. So after the 11th Circuit created its initial ruling, R.J. Reynolds went back and petitioned the court to hear it with a larger group of judges, basically. So you had more people listening to the arguments, and based on that, you had a more diverse opinion.
And Peter, your thoughts. Were you surprised that the Supreme Court didn't, U.S. Supreme Court didn't take this up?
Actually, I'm not surprised that the high court didn't take it up. There's not yet a clear split between the circuit courts. There's almost certainly going to be one. There's a case out in California that went the other way. That's going up to the circuit. So I think this is going to be brought back to the high court, the Supreme Court.
So there are more cases working through the system that'll bring greater clarity, you think?
Well, I don't know whether they'll bring greater clarity, but they'll bring the issue back to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. You were about to say before I jumped in?
Well, I am surprised by the 11th Circuit majority's ruling in that the decision itself was split all sorts of ways, and in general, both that court and all circuit courts, when the law is confusing, generally defer to the regulating agency, and in this case, it's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And the EEOC has said for the 50 years that the Age Discrimination and Employment Act has been around that it applies both to employees and applicants.
Yeah, and Paul, that seems to be where the discrepancy lies, right? In what the ADEA says and what the EEOC says on this issue.
That's right. So the EEOC is charged basically with interpreting and creating regulations from statutes that Congress writes that aren't usually able to cover as wide of a range of topics as the EEOC and its expertise is able to do. And so what our caller is talking about is basically deference to the regulating agencies. And so that's what the 11th Circuit initially deferred to. And then the 11th Circuit en banc decided, wait a second, let's take another look. No, the statute isn't quite as ambiguous as we thought initially. And that's where that's probably why we're here talking about this right now.
So let's lay a bit of the foundation here. Mr. Villarreal is the man who filed this claim. He's applying for a job at R.J. Reynolds that he clearly felt he was qualified for. He didn't get the job, and he feels it's because of age discrimination. At the time, he's 49 years old. What do you need, Paul? I guess this is a question for you. What do you need to prove in order to bring a successful claim of age discrimination? And that's at the heart of this, at least part of it.
That's right. So what the ADEA allows is basically kind of two parallel avenues towards proving up age discrimination claim. So we'll keep that in this context for now. But either you have intentional discrimination, which we call disparate treatment, where in Mr. Villarreal would have said they intentionally discriminated against me because of my age, and I have to prove that intent. So that's what you're asking. And then what he brought additionally as an employment applicant was what's called a disparate impact case. And that's where typically you have to use statistics to demonstrate that there's a negative impact on your class as, let's say, an older employee.
Yeah. And Peter, when you took a look at this case, what aspects of it did you find interesting?
Well, it was fascinating for a number of reasons. Mr. Villarreal applied, as almost everybody does today, online. Yeah. And if you've ever been looking for a job and applied online, you really don't know a thing about what happens after you push the send button. Villarreal pushed the send button several times and heard nothing and thought nothing of it. That's the way the world works. And in fact, there are loads of surveys that show that. Almost 3 years later, a whistleblower came forward with the statistics that Paul talks about. To my eyes, pretty convincing statistics that the company had told the people sorting the applications coming in online, don't take people over 35 years old.
Oh.
The two amazing things about the case, I think, are that the 11th Circuit majority said, well, wait, Villarreal didn't do anything about to diligently, in the words of the court, pursue his interest in the job or to find an answer to why he'd heard nothing. Mm-hmm. And then it also said that, oh, by the way, the law, which has for 50 years applied to both applicants and employees, doesn't apply to applicants. Both pretty interesting positions.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Paul Chichester, an Atlanta-based employment attorney. Also with us is Peter Goslin, contributing reporter for ProPublica. Do we understand, is it clear to you, Paul, that filing this claim earlier would have had resulted in a different impact, a different outcome for Mr. Villarreal?
That's an interesting question. Probably not the way the 11th Circuit ended up holding and said, hey, you are out of luck completely because you can't bring these claims under the ADEA. So that's the question we're talking about. But what another interesting point is that Peter raises is that to discover this, if it hadn't been for the whistleblower, how would Mr. Villarreal have ever known?
So how do you bring a case against a company that, you know, you're claiming just doesn't hire older workers? That's your claim, a pattern in practice of your company is that you don't hire older workers. How do you do that? You need, as in this case, as Peter just mentioned, a whistleblower, it seems to me, to come forward with evidence, with data.
That's right. Apart from that, you would have to file an EEOC charge against the company. You would have to have some kind of sincere belief that you had been discriminated against. Do your due diligence a little bit, but go to a plaintiff's attorney and then say, hey, I think I may have been, but I can't tell.
And Peter, the larger issue is what's happening with older workers. And we know life tells us that it's getting more. We're an older society and we're changing jobs multiple times in the course of a career. What's happening to older workers in our society right now? And how difficult is it to bring kind of an age discrimination case when that doesn't seem to be the type of case that's getting a lot of attention in our society right now?
Well, let me say a couple things. One is that because jobs are changing, people change jobs a lot.
Yes.
It's important throughout the work life that there be a robust hiring market. And one of the reasons why I've started this beat at ProPublica to look at this issue is that it seems to me that you pass some sort of invisible barrier at age 50, 55, maybe a little later, where the hiring market just doesn't work the same way for older workers that it does than it does for people in their so-called prime years. The Congress and the administration used to take this issue, certainly in the 60s and the 70s, much more seriously, and that's why we have the ADEA. It was treated very much like the Title VII, the laws that apply to race, gender, and other sorts of discrimination. But over the last 25 years, the courts have interpreted the law much, much more narrowly than they do for gender and race. And so it's gotten to do something when you don't get a job or when you are treated poorly in the workplace or when you are laid off is much more difficult.
And I guess we should, for the record here, state what ultimately happened in this case, how the 11th Circuit decided this case, Paul.
Sure. So they basically said, sorry, Mr. Villarreal, your claim that you were discriminated against based on what is called a facially neutral hiring practice, which is a program that's out there that's just sifting through people based on age, you can't bring that under the ADA. You have no right of action.
You have no standing.
You have no standing to be in the court.
And why not?
Because the law doesn't protect you.
As an applicant.
As an applicant, and it's a very narrow carve-out, so that's important.
Yeah. If you were an employee and you made a claim that you were demoted, or you were fired because of your age, then you would have standing and grounds based on this decision to move forward with a lawsuit or a claim of age discrimination?
That's right. Based on your hypothetical, that would probably be more disparate treatment, but we could come up with a hypothetical where it'd be a disparate impact, let's say in a reduction in force type of thing. If you look at certain statistics and all of a sudden more older employees are being cut in a reduction in force, then you might have that disparate impact as an employee claim, which you could still bring under the ADEA.
And Peter, let me give you the last word on this. Where do you see this issue moving? You mentioned at least one case. Are there other cases that are working through the system now that might shine a light or certainly bring this issue back to the forefront of attention?
Yes, there are cases in Illinois, at least Illinois and California. I mean, to Paul's point, and to the majority opinion's point at the 11th Circuit, I mean, the language in the black letter law is confusing, to say the least. What is surprising about this case, and the reason why I think these other cases, this issue is going to come up again and again, is that if you go back and you read the congressional testimony when the ADEA was passed in 1967, it's clear as a light of day that the two concerns that the members of Congress had were that older, capable workers were able to get hired, and that workforces should be age diverse. And the notion that we have a law
and
the purpose of which is age diversity.
Peter, my apologies. We are flat out of time, but thank you both. Paul,
apology.
Peter, thank you. Thank you both for your time on this topic. We're back in a moment. This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. An in-depth investigation by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reveals a large number of doctors nationwide sexually abused patients with little or no repercussions. Georgia's medical board recently concluded a year-long review of these cases, but rather than push for new patient protections as some states have, the board says it will focus on educating doctors about the importance of reporting colleagues they suspect of abuse. My colleague, Celeste Headlee, spoke with AJC reporters Ariel Hart and Danny Robbins. They were part of the AJC team behind the coverage.
Let's go back a little bit, Ariel, to how this all began and when you and other reporters began looking into allegations of sexual abuse in medical offices.
Well, this really grew out of Danny's work. He was looking at another doctor and just out of an abundance of rigor. He requested records from the Georgia Medical Board on physicians, and he just noticed something odd, which was all of these doctors who had been disciplined for sexual misconduct seemed to be getting their licenses back. And so the paper decided to look into that further.
And what you found, Danny, was shocking, first of all, but the reporting in and of itself was difficult because of the nature of the abuse. I want to play this comment from David Klossy, who oversees SNAP. That's an advocacy group for people who have been sexually abused by priests and doctors and other figures of authority. He spoke with you and the rest of the AGC reporters for the series, and he's talking about how difficult it is to get victims to come forward.
I think if you haven't experienced sexual exploitation or violence, it's really hard to understand how and why it's so devastating. You know, there is no more deeply personal betrayal than this, because it's a betrayal on a physical and an emotional level and psychological level all at the same time.
How hard was it for you to get people to go on the record?
Some harder than others, but some were very willing to talk. The thing about this story, Celeste, is many of these people were victimized multiple times, first by a doctor and then by the system. The system would let them down because the doctor would remain in practice. And it was interesting, many of the people, a lot of these victims were sort of hidden away. We found them through the documents we looked at, and then we would approach them, and I was surprised at the number of victims who would say, well, he's in prison, or he's in jail, right? And then you would say, no, he's not. And many of them were willing to be forthcoming because they were so angry at the way the system had treated them after they had come forward.
And Ariel, this is one of the things we talked about before, how difficult it is actually to discipline doctors, because in many cases, as I understand, not only were the doctors not put in jail, but many of them retained their licenses, correct?
Many of them retained their licenses. And we will say we may only know the tip of the iceberg of cases, because there's this vast infrastructure of secret, not even discipline, but secret dealing with this issue that has grown up with medical boards. And I think it's highly possible that the vast majority are now dealt with secret orders, so that if for the specific purpose of not endangering the practice of these doctors. But yes, the ones that we were able to look at, overall, half retained their licenses, and in Georgia, about two-thirds retained active
right.
licenses.
One of the doctors, one of the cases you talk about in the series is the case of Dr. Andrew Deakle of Cairo, Georgia, sentenced to 4 years in prison. So there's one who actually got sentenced. He was trading prescriptions for sexual favors, but he regained his license. One of the patients who testified at his trial was a woman named Cindy Sheridan.
To be abused by a husband and then turn around and be abused by my doctor, you know, it was a double whammy. This was like in a five-year period. I would try so hard to detox at home so I wouldn't have to go to him. But I always ended up going back.
And I want to play this other comment. This is Kim Johnson, who was both a nurse and a patient of Andrew Deakle, and she defends him.
Dr. Deakle will be honest, and he'll say, I did stupid stuff, and I got in trouble, and, you know, that's how we learn. He didn't go out there looking for it. It came to him. Yes, that's where he crossed the line, and he was wrong, but he paid his price. And he has proven to everyone in the community, to everyone here, he's here for good.
Why is it so difficult to remove a license of a doctor? Why is it so hard to take away a doctor's license or their access to patients if they have committed sexual assault or sexual abuse in the past?
Well, one thing, the context for that story, there's only a very small handful of states, and I think it's four, five, or six, where a felony for sexual misconduct means you cannot practice medicine.
Right.
Georgia is one where that's not, does not prohibit it. It's all done on an ad hoc basis. So, a doctor can go in there, make his case to other doctors, basically on the medical board, and you don't know A lot of it's done behind closed doors in committees where, look, I'm in a small town. I want to help these people and make a case. But when you go back and look at a case like Dr. Deagle, there are people who feel like he's a great doctor in that small town. But someone like Cindy Sheridan is seriously addicted to drugs, and he used that to for sexual gratification. And the Georgia Bureau of Investigation did their investigation on him, found close to 400 photos of female patients in his office, nude photos of women who had posed in exchange for the drugs. So you look at both sides. But in answer to your question, doctors judging other doctors, not wanting to lose that someone who is in that profession,
and they don't want to set a precedent either.
It's deference. And another point is doctors have the ability to have the best lawyers, maybe more than other people, and then those lawyers will go in and negotiate with the medical board. It's a system with various pieces in it, but the ultimate end game is they continue to practice or lose their license and then come back.
And I would add to that the whole system is really set up on behalf of the doctors. The boards see themselves as the patient's advocate, but the way the system is set up really redounds to the benefit of the doctors. First of all, a lot of states, the doctors argue that their medical license is a property right. So that starts this whole legal parameter.
Not a privilege, but a right.
Exactly. And you can see, like, in medical canons and medical ethics going back for centuries, the ability to practice medicine is always talked about as a privilege, but that's not what they argue when they go to court and they win. And so the patients are never given the ability to go into court and say, well, my right not to be violated is a right too, that that ought to counterbalance this. That kind of balance never happens. It's always the doctor versus the state. And the other thing is that the laws, you don't have this big infrastructure of patients' rights lobbies. You have a massive infrastructure of doctors' rights lobbies. You've got the American Medical Association, and then more importantly, the individual state medical associations that have well-paid lobbyists going in to battle for protections for doctors against patients, against accusations. And all of that creates a system where a doctor is really protected when they go in against a board.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporters Ariel Hart and Danny Robbins. They're part of the team that investigated medical doctors who were accused of sexual abuse, and that series was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And I didn't say congratulations, so congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
We got straight into the nitty-gritty here. You guys spoke with William Allman. Dr. William Allman, about his past and the accusations of sexual misconduct that were made against him over the years. Here's just a portion of what he told you.
I enjoy being a physician. What I don't enjoy is feeling like I have to look over my shoulder because once you have one complaint, there's a target on your back. People looked into these things. It was investigated by all the authorities, and what happened happened, and I accepted that. And I have gone on. That's where I am right now.
So two things here. Danny, tell me about Dr. William Allman first, and then we'll get to why I'm not quite convinced that the past seems to follow these doctors around, because it seems like it's kind of difficult, actually, for patients to find out about this history. But tell me about his specific case.
Well, absolutely. These were three very, very different charges in three very different settings. He was... He left the military after he was accused of sexual misconduct with a patient, and then that was at Fort Gordon, and then he went to work part-time as the doctor at the Augusta Jail. He was again accused of sexual misconduct there. He was actually charged and arrested there. The charges ultimately were dropped, but there were issues about the exams he gave those women, so he was penalized again by the medical board. Then he came over to the Atlanta area and worked for WellStar in Paulding County. Again, women complained, and there he was charged again. He ultimately pled guilty to sexual battery. But one of the charges against him was actually involved a minor. And and the medical board still did. Usually they'll take your license temporarily. In his case, they didn't. And so in each of the, but he was one of several doctors we found with multiple cases in multiple places with victims who never knew each other, who were still practicing medicine as they kind of went from place to place.
But one of the things that he describes here, Ariel, is this feeling like he's followed around by his past. But through your reporting, it sounds to me like it's actually quite difficult for a patient to find out.
It's incredibly difficult. And that's one of the things that really stuck out to us is that secrecy is used as leverage by the boards, by hospitals, by everyone who deals with these doctors. Look, just get off of our staff and we won't tell anyone. One hospital CEO said to me, he was talking about basically how proud he was at having gotten a doctor to leave who he knew was molesting patients. And he said to me, well, would you have left that grenade sitting in your house? And I said, no, but on no account would I have rolled it into my neighbor's house. And he had just never thought of it that way. Patients who want to find out about their doctors, I mean, I'm sorry, who among us ever thought, go on the medical board website for your state and look for the database of board orders. Even if you're that smart, you're not going to see the wealth of information that never makes it to a board order because there are secret orders, because a doctor successfully argues his case, because they negotiate the order down to the vaguest possible terms, because they can't even find it on the board website. And in the case of William Ahman, I mean, that was Danny's reporting, and he's got this, a massive amount of reporting on this guy with horrific detail, to the extent that I happened to run into a colleague of Dr. Ahman's at a conference, and she was livid that we were even looking into it, because she had no idea herself. She was a colleague of this guy. She had no idea what he had done.
And I would just emphasize, in his case and all the others that I looked at, with multiple victims, the victims never knew each other. In fact, in Dr. Ahman's case, the two that came forward at Wellstar, one was a 40-year-old woman, one was a 16-year-old girl who had seen him on different occasions, had no clue who the others were until the very end. And we looked at another case at the University of Wisconsin Hospital with four women who came forward around the same time. No connection. The target may exist in some places, but in the cases we looked at, that was not what we saw.
I want to emphasize why it took the amount of dedication and resources on the AJC's part to look into this, because it is difficult to get this information. Here is Josh Riley. He's a detective with the Wilmington Police Department in Ohio. He handled a case of sexual abuse by a doctor, and he says in the end, well, let's let him describe it.
It's difficult when you have a physician and a patient in a room with no cameras, no nurses, no one else, and they do something of a sexual nature, say something, ask for something, or just flat out do something, and there's no witnesses and there's no way of proving it. You are down to he said, she said, she said, he said. How do we prove it?
How much is that made even more difficult by the fact that in addition to all of the normal difficulties of a sexual assault case, you have a doctor who's well-respected and then a patient who is often not?
And you have examinations where you're sitting there and vulnerable, and a male doctor and a female patient in a gown. And
they're supposed to touch you.
Yes. And and so many of the people we talked to, did this really happen to me? Is what you also heard. So it's a situation where they're set up like this. In the case that Josh Riley was talking about, a woman went back in with a tape recorder to get him to say some things. And even then, they weren't sure what they can do. This is a small town in Ohio. They ultimately had another woman read about the case in the paper, came forward and had DNA. But the reason we focused on that case was they said, look, we wouldn't have been able to do anything without this DNA because these were in closed door examinations, the women's word against a doctor who was a respected person in the community.
In the minute we have left, Ariel, is the reporting continuing?
The reporting is continuing. The really full-on effort, the main project, concluded at the end of the year. But as we continue to see impact from the project, we've been very gratified to see a few states really take the results to heart and try and do something within their legislatures. We're continuing to report on that.
Those were the voices of reporters Ariel Hart and Danny Robbins of the AJC, speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. The AJC's coverage of sex abuse by doctors was a finalist this year for the Pulitzer Prize. In Georgia, that investigation prompted the state's medical board to launch its own review. The board last month concluded that it would do a better job of educating doctors about the importance of reporting suspected abusers. It also said it would investigate allegations and involve law enforcement when appropriate. Finally, the board said it will revoke medical licenses and discipline doctors with public consent orders when allegations are found to be true. Georgia still has no law requiring doctors to report possible violations by fellow doctors. Just ahead, we will hang out with some model train enthusiasts. But first, the story of a train heist that could have ended the Civil War. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris, filling in for Celeste Headley. Tomorrow, we will talk about the state of drinking water in Georgia. Do you trust the tap where you live? Were you affected by the boil water requirements in Atlanta last week? Just give us a call at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message. You can also let us know on Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the program. This year marks 155 years since a daring operation happened in Georgia to try and end the Civil War. A team of Union soldiers planned to steal a train and destroy railroad bridges, tunnels, and telegraph lines to the south. All of this was a plot to derail the Confederacy. The locomotive captured in that raid is now on display at the Southern Museum of Civil War and Locomotive History in Kennesaw. Historian Mark Wortman wrote about the train robbery for the website The Daily Beast, and he joins me now from Connecticut. Mark, let's start here. Let's put everyone in the time and place of this terrific piece that you've written for The Daily Beast. When did the great train chase actually take place, and what was the state of the Civil War at that moment?
In April 1862, the Union forces had taken down into Nashville and eastern Tennessee, and Confederate forces were massed in Chattanooga. And the Union forces wanted to figure their way into Georgia. This was really an opportunity to put a knife right into the heart of the of what was known as the Western Theater mm-hmm. at the time, but really today the heart of the Deep South. And the Union forces were stymied. They were not making headway, and so they were preparing for a major attack on Chattanooga with the idea that if you could take Chattanooga, you could cut the transportation networks, the communications link as that ran from the Mississippi, from Memphis, all the way up to Virginia. And the war theater in Virginia, as well as links to the coast. And so getting Chattanooga was really going to be key to that strategy.
Right. And Mark, let's do this. Let's set out some of the characters in this piece. First of all, who was Alf Wilson? And then there was another character, Mark Wood. And maybe let's throw one more in here, James J. Andrews. Who were these characters?
Okay. Yeah. So you mentioned the first two you mentioned were privates from Ohio, from an infantry regiment out of Ohio.
And this is Wilson and Wood.
Yes. And they were among the 22 Union soldiers and one additional civilian who were recruited by James Andrews. James Andrews was a civilian. He was a kind of shady character. He was somebody who went back and forth across the lines, as many did, and he was trading in contraband, essentially doing illegal trading, but at the same time, he was acting as a spy for Union forces and going into northwestern Georgia, through Tennessee and into northwestern Georgia, trading goods that the Southern forces needed, and also collecting information that he was bringing back to the Union Army.
Wow.
And he concocted this idea that if you could cut the Western and Atlanta and Atlantic Railroad line, which ran from Atlanta up to Chattanooga, that you could block the resupply of the Confederate Army that was there and that the Union forces couldn't get past. So he presented this idea to the Union generals, and they bought it. And so then he collected this force of Union soldiers, primarily from an Ohio infantry regiment, including Mark Worden and Alf Wilson, who agreed to take their uniforms off, put on civilian clothes, and then in small groups infiltrate through the Confederate lines and then head south into Georgia, eventually to assemble in Marietta with the idea that once they got there, they would get together, board a train, eventually steal that train and head back toward Chattanooga and the Union lines, destroying the single-track railroad line behind them. You know, in some ways, it was a brilliant idea. In other ways, it was very poorly thought out. But it was with the idea that if you could cut this line while simultaneously the Union forces would mass and carry out an attack, the Confederates would be unable to resupply, they would be unable to bring troops forward, and that they could then take this major railroad junction at Chattanooga, and from there they'd be set up to move through the South.
And Mark, and, for a while it was working. The plan was actually working.
They almost pulled it off. They almost pulled it off. So that from Marietta, they boarded a train, all 22 of them, 23 including Andrews. They took, this is an early morning train, they took it to Kennesaw, today's Kennesaw. Back then it was known as Big Shanty. That train had the locomotive, the General, pulling it. When they got to Big Shanty, Kennesaw, the train crew got out and went for their breakfast. And when they did, Andrews and two other men went to the engine. They saw that there was nobody in the cab of the engine. They uncoupled the passenger cars, and then the rest of the men came out of the passenger car, went into a boxcar, and they started out. And this is in the midst of a Confederate Army camp.
Yes.
There were 3,000 soldiers around there.
Now, that's pretty bold. That's pretty bold and brazen.
It is incredibly bold, brazen, and risky.
Yeah.
And some of them eventually paid the price for that risk.
So who is Bill Fuller?
Okay. William Bill Fuller was a conductor who was on that train that came out of Atlanta, a Confederate through and through. Yeah. He was sitting in what was then the Lacey Hotel having his breakfast. And he looks up and he sees, my God, my train is puffing out and leaving the station.
And I'm not on.
Yeah. And so he raced out, and he said people all around were laughing. They didn't realize the seriousness of this. And he started running up the track after this locomotive that's puffing out of sight. And Andrews and his men stopped. They cut the telegraph lines so that word could not be sent ahead to try and stop them. And then they continued on up the line with the intention of eventually reaching points where they could destroy the rails, and they were intending to burn bridges and block tunnels.
And at a certain point, Andrews and his team, they get bogged down, right?
Yeah.
And it allows an opportunity for a bit of a catch-up here, which gets us to the moment when the plan, the plot, falls apart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so they are heading north, and as they're heading north, at several points, there are southbound trains.
Yes.
And the southbound trains are supposed to have priority because they're coming down from the front. And these southbound trains have pulled off onto sidings, but in some cases they're still blocking part of that northbound track that that Andrews and his men were heading on. So this would slow them down. And at each stop, each time they slowed down, he, again, being incredibly brazen, he said, "We have boxcar loads of gunpowder." You know, his men are in these boxcars with their guns, terrified that they're going to be taken there. And he tells them, "We have these boxcars of gunpowder. We have to get it to the front. The Union forces are mustering for an attack, so we've got to get through." And so they are passed through at each stage. Meanwhile, Fuller reaches one of those sidings where there is a locomotive waiting with a head of steam. And he tells him, "In fact, this is what's going on. My train has been stolen." He doesn't quite know why it's been stolen, but it's been stolen. And so he gets three successive locomotives that he can start heading up the track on and start trying to chase down the train robbers.
This is amazing stuff. So I don't want to give away the climactic moments here when everything comes to a head, because I want folks to read your piece in the Daily Beast. But there is a moment when it all goes bad for James Andrews and his crew, correct?
Yes.
And when we say it goes badly for them, what ultimately happens to the men who were involved in this?
Eventually, they had to abandon their mission. They fled out into the countryside, and they were all captured. And they were all court-martialed and charged as spies, although there's a real question as to whether this was the right way to deal with the men. And eight of them, Andrews first, were executed in Atlanta. They were hanged, and all of the men were eventually going to be hanged.
And there's a tremendous moment at the beginning of the story where you talk about Alf Wilson and Mark Wood, essentially being discovered, being rescued. And I'll save that for the readers of your piece, Mark. But I do want to ask you this, because I think this is a fascinating a point that you make here. How might the war have changed if that operation had actually been successful?
Sure. I think that if they had succeeded, Union forces had a good chance of breaking through there and driving right through the heart of Georgia. Essentially, what would happen in 3 years, 2 years, more than 2 years later, when Sherman came down this exact same path into Atlanta and then made his march to the sea. This could have potentially have prevented the immense war of attrition that took place and preventing hundreds of thousands of casualties. It would have been a very, very different war.
That's historian Mark Wortman talking about a failed 1862 military raid aboard a steam locomotive in Georgia. That raid, had it been successful, would have been a major blow to the Confederacy. That locomotive is on display at the Southern Museum of Civil War and Locomotive History in Kennesaw. You can find details at gpbnews.org. And now let's visit some more modern trains. When I was a kid, I loved playing with model trains. I don't know about you, but I really did. it was exciting to watch them whiz by on tiny tracks, right? Well, earlier this year, Atlanta hosted a convention for model train enthusiasts of all stripes. GPB's Sean Powers went and brought back this audio postcard.
Okay, guys, we have to keep our legs out straight, and we have to pedal to make it go. And most importantly, we have to have fun. Everybody ready?
Yeah!
My name's Larry Williams, and this is Train on Time, is what I've called this little business. This is Hodges Hand Cars. They were manufactured from 1937 to 1957. It has handles on the top, which you pedal, and there's a chain that connects to the rear wheels, and that's what propels it. Every kid goes their individual speed.
Go fast!
Go, William! Go, William! Go, William!
Go, Hayes! Go, Abby Lynn!
Good job, Hazy!
My name is Rick Scott, here from Norcross, Georgia. I'm here with my grandchildren, Aubriana and Jalen.
I'm Jalen from Duluth, Georgia.
And hers is
Aubriana Davis. My favorite kind of train is a train that goes really fast.
I like the ones where, like, I like the super speed trains, and I like the ones that you can sleep over in the night.
I want to drive the train. I can go like 50% when people are not watching.
It's unbelievable because some kids, such as that little girl, I mean, she just comes alive. She looks at a train, her eyes open up, she just gets so excited. And, you know, she's not even tall enough to reach the table yet. And it's exciting to see somebody that young, that excited about, you know, something like model trains. My name is Vic Auto, and I'm with Athern and Horizon Hobby, and we're based in Champaign, Illinois.
Okay, we're getting ready to get started, so we got to tell people we're coming. All right, now change the speed with this dial.
To 4?
If you want to, yeah.
I want it to go backwards again.
Oh, you do? Well, you remember how to do that?
So first, load all the way down.
That's pretty neat, isn't it? You like trains, don't you?
My name is Jamie Hamilton. I'm from Cartersville, Georgia. I'm a member of North Georgia Modular Rail. We all each develop a different table that can be joined together in any different way. And so we'll set up and do shows at churches or events or things like that. Well, everybody's got a different story that they like to do. This particular story you're seeing in front of is the old Atlanta Terminal Station. So it's a little bit of history mixed in with that. Other people choose different scenes that they like. So as you walk around, you'll see 20 different scenes. Generally, the older folks that grew up in Atlanta and remember this station, they tend to recognize what they're looking at here, and they really enjoy that and sharing their stories.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. And for photos from the Model Train Show, just visit gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today. But we always welcome your comments. Model trains are a fun hobby. What's your favorite hobby? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us at Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headley. Have a great day.